All right, we're going to go ahead and get started at 1 o'clock. For anyone that just came in, Evan, over here in the plaid shirt, he's got an Ask It basket. So if you have a question for Bob or Valerie on inventory or men, something like that, feel free to write it down, and we'll turn them over to Bob and Valerie here in a little bit. So we're going to get started this afternoon. I want to thank everybody again for bringing in a dish and participating this morning and at our lunch. We're going to wrap it up this afternoon with helping others, and I'll turn it over to Bob.
Thanks.
I'm Bob Darrow. I'm an alcoholic. That was a good lunch. I think if I went to an AA potluck every day, I'd be an OA before the end of the year. We like to eat. Anything that gives me the illusion of filling up the empty spaces in me, I'm in. Little commercial. Don't like to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. There's some flyers over there for an event that happens on the anniversary of the day Bill Wilson got sober, the only event in the world that celebrates when Bill got sober, December 11th. It's 14 speakers. It's a unique event in Las Vegas. The best communicators come to bear talking about their experience with the step they're most fluent in talking about. It's a remarkable weekend, very affordable. The suites at this hotel, it's a beautiful four-star hotel, $58 a night.
Oh my God.
And it sells out. I'm not trying to promote it because it's a limited to 1,100 people. It sells out every year. For 10, this is our 11th year, it sells out. It'll be sold out probably by June or July usually. But it's exciting sometimes to have people that have never gone to go because it does something to you. It's a great event. So we're starting to see how we're wrong. And you can almost feel, as you go through East resentment and have that shift in perception and see how you were wrong about that person, it's like incremental deflation of the ego. And Harry Thiebaud talks about how the alcoholic must have ego deflation at depth. And this is where it begins, to dismantling this self-righteous judgment machine that has caused a lot of conflict and separation between me and life and me and people and me and God. Because it's funny how you can't be close to God and hate his kids. Right, and the illusion, and that's what, see, I wanted to, me and God like this, and me and you like I can still remain conscious of how screwed up you are. But as I separate, my distance from you equates to my distance from God. And so in order to get closer to God, I got to get closer to his kids. And I got, separation is separation. And so I dismantle the judgments in the resentment list, and now I'm looking at fear. The book says that we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And it's so much a driving force in my life, and it has been for so long that I don't recognize it. And some of us have developed and cultivated certain defense mechanisms in ourselves that make it at times impossible to even recognize fear, that's really what's going on, because we jump knee-jerk immediately to anger. And there's really something's threatened. We're scared. And so it's hard for some of us to see fear. I remember writing my first inventory, and I was stuck. I finished the resentment section. This is the first, this is a little over 4 years sober. The resentment section was actually pretty easy. I did a great job. And oddly enough, when you do your first legitimate resentment inventory and you're sober 4 years, most of the people are in AA. I mean, because you notice. You go to meetings, and there's an old adage: if you don't resent anybody in AA, you're not going to any meetings. I mean, So that was pretty easy. But then I get to the fear thing, and I'm stuck. I can't realize any fear. And an old timer who was from out of town, speaking in our intergroup, walked me through it by asking me some questions. When I told him that I was doing a fear inventory and I didn't have any fear, he had the most peculiar look on his face. And he said, can I ask you some questions? And I said, yeah, sure. And he started with like simple things that everybody's afraid of. You know, like you're afraid of large, angry, barking dogs and rattlesnakes and black widow spiders. And then he started reeling it in more personally. Are you afraid of what people think of you? Are you afraid of dying old alone? Are you afraid of getting sick and not being able to take care of yourself? Are you afraid of losing your job and being broke and homeless? Are you afraid of success and then what will people expect of me? Are you? And he just, you know, on and on and on and on. Are you afraid of stuff out of your past? Are you afraid that God really doesn't love someone like you? And then he went on and on and on, and he just kept hitting me. And then when he was done asking me all these questions, he said, so is there anything you're not afraid of? And I said, how did you do that? I wasn't afraid of anything before I started talking to this guy. He must be he's contagious. He's a carrier. That's what he is. And actually, I had hidden fear from myself. I am so driven by fear that my looking for fear is like a fish looking for water. It's the driving force in my life. And I don't see it. It affects what I believe in. It affects my judgments. It affects, it's throughout my whole resentment list. It's just fear-based. Things were threatened. It's the driving force. In the 12 steps and 12 traditions, in step 7, Wilson says that self-centered fear is the chief activator of all our defects of character. Fear is the muscle of the ego. If your ego wants you to play God and you're fairly surrendered, it's going to have to scare you. And if it scares you, you'll grab hold of the wheel and you'll start running the show again and you'll start controlling things. But it's, you don't go from a surrendered servant who's one with the universe and one with God and one with the people around him to the guy who's running the show and in conflict with everybody over just like that. I think what happens is my ego, as it chatters to me, it worries me into the control position slowly and incrementally. And I don't often understand the journey. It's just all of a sudden I'm in a shitstorm, right? And it's of my own doing, and I don't know what's happened here because I'm not awake to what happened. And it's so subtle and so insinuous. It's the way your ego talks to you, the way it just chatters. Do you ever have one of those mornings where you wake up and your head's just waiting for you with a list of possible threat assessments for the day, you know, and the things that you should be worrying about, and if you go and you pay attention to it and you give it energy, then you'll take it into your day. The book says something very interesting. It says not only is our very fabric of our existence shot through with this fear, but that fear in and of itself causes more problems because it's a motivating, driving force that will set in motion trains of circumstances that eventually bring you more problems. And that's really true. I heard a speaker 35 years ago say, I've never had a problem in my life that has hurt me as much as my solutions to my problems. and what psychologists call that self-fulfilling prophecies. And what that's about, I'll give you a couple examples. My first sober relationship. I mean, I don't have nothing to bring to the table except vacancy. You know, I'm just needy. I just love me, take care of me, feel me, validate me. You know, I just have an empty shell. I'm like a black hole of love. You know, you can't love me enough. I'm just me, me, me. And which that doesn't make good relationships, right? So I go into this relationship, and because I'm so obsessed with this person and so afraid, what am I afraid of? That they're going to leave me, right? So what happens? The fear, unbeknownst to me, starts driving me and affecting my actions and the way I position and show up in life. Until in time, the fear has gotten such a grip on me that I would drive by her apartment in the middle of the night and peek in the windows to make sure no guy's there. Mm. It would drive me to watch her in meetings and see if she's looking at any guys. It would drive me. I remember one time I almost got in a fight with a guy who she hugged during a meeting. After the meeting, I'm saying, "Hey, don't be hugging like her." You know, he thinks I'm crazy because they're just friends, right? He thinks I'm a nutcase. And what happened? I didn't even know I was smothering her until eventually the fear drove me to consistently position myself in such a way that I literally drove her out of my life. And I'm not even awake to that I'm doing that. And I did that. I made the fear that she was going to leave me come true. Mm-hmm. I made it come true. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know I'm doing that. But the nice thing about making your fears come true is that when they do come true, the little voice in your head goes, "See, you were right." Yeah. I like being right. I'm miserable. I feel like drinking. I'm gut shot. But I'm right. I like being right. I did that with jobs where I was afraid that the people there didn't like me, and it drove me to position myself in such a way that they didn't like me. It's funny, if you are afraid someone doesn't like you and you come at them like they don't like you, it's no time at all. They will not like you. It's like amazing how you get to, and you're the co-creator of your own heaven or hell. You're the co-creator of your own heaven or hell. And the sad part is most of us choose hell, and we don't know we're doing it. We don't know we're doing it. So what do we do with fear? Well, the book says we do a couple things. The first thing is we list our fears. You know, when it says driven by 100 forms of fear, there were things that I didn't understand were fears. There were people that I had harmed or stolen from or did things to that I had no resentments in connection with. And I didn't understand that my hurting you created an anxiety and an apprehension in me. It's subtle, but I think it's impossible for me to hurt one of God's kids and not have apprehension and anxiety about some kind of cosmic retribution. Right? Almost as if I diminish my sense of worthiness to receive abundance because of the things I've done. Right? Now, this is not a conscious thing, but it's not the conscious things that hurt me as much as the things I'm not awake to. I remember when I was working as a trying to be a counselor, that there was a thing we used back in those days, some of you may be familiar with this, called the Johari window. And the Johari window was a window with four panes, and it was a way of seeing into yourself. And the first pane was the absolute both ways transparent pane. It was everything I know about me and you know about me. It's clear both ways. You can see, it's clear. The second pane is the pane that's like one of those windows in an interrogation room. You can see through. This is everything I can see about me, but you can't see it. It's reflective on that side. So this is my secret room. The things I know about me, but you don't know about me. And this starts to be cleared and made transparent in the fourth step. The third window is a little more devious. These are the things that you know about me. They're obvious to you. I don't have a clue. Everybody knows I'm... Everybody knows this stuff except me. And alcoholics who are sober a while to work the steps, we are armed with information about ourselves that make us... If we wanted to, we could really have a lot of fun at the new people's expense. And we often do, sometimes, because we know stuff about them they don't know. And they won't know until you tell them. You could walk up to any newcomer, brand new, hopeless, and just look them in the eye and go, "You've been worrying a lot about yourself lately, haven't you?" And they'll look at you, "How'd you know that?" Right? And they didn't even know they were doing that until you said it. And when you said it, they go, "Yes, I am. How did you know that?" Right? Well, because we know ourselves, right? And so your sponsor and in AA will start to clear that pain. And then the last pain in the window is the pain that God clears. And that's the stuff that I don't know about me, and I can't see about me, and neither can you. This is the deep stuff. This is the stuff when it says in the book, more will be disclosed. God will constantly disclose more to you and to others. Is that I'm going to open up here. And eventually, you and I are both going to start to know some stuff about Bob that you and I have never known about Bob. And you can't control that. That is in God's hands and is God's time as he cleans that window. And so in this process of, as Chuck used to say, my grand sponsor, uncovering, discovering, and discarding, we're really getting rid of everything that's been blocking us. And fear is one of the driving forces and one of the great blocks between me and God. Because the answer to fear in the book, it says, it's what do we do? You know, it says, you know, when it made us cocky, some of us choose cockiness. We try to cover up the fear by acting proactive, by more controlling. It doesn't work. It makes it worse. So the book says, what do we do? And it says, well, perhaps there's a better way. Hope so. Because that other crap ain't working. Perhaps there's a better way, and it's that we're now on a different basis. Remember step three? Remember the pivotal point that we're trying to pivot our life in the direction of self-abandonment service? We're on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. Well, trust is not easy for guys like me. Trust is like an atrophied, unused muscle. I don't trust. I hedge my bet. I'm guarded, defensive. I'm a thinker. I'm a figurer. And I'm a standoffish, look from the sidelines and watch you kind of guy. I don't jump in the pool. So what happens? Well, there's an old story. I heard this almost 36 years ago. When it talks in the book about trust, this is where Alcoholics Anonymous rises above faith. People try to say that AA is faith-based recovery. It's not faith-based. Faith isn't enough here. There's men and women with more faith than most of us will ever have that drink themselves to death. But it is self-abandonment and trusting in God-based. And this guy told me this story. He said, "You have a lot of faith," he said, "but you're full of anxiety and depression because you don't trust God." And he said, "If you went to a circus and you sat in the audience and you watched a tight wire act and you watched a man come out on the platform at the edge of the wire and he's pushing a wheelbarrow, you could sit in the audience with all the faith in the world. He's a professional. I have complete faith. He can walk across that tight wire pushing that wheelbarrow. I bet you've done 1,000 times. Absolute faith he can do it. But if you trusted, you'd go up and get in the wheelbarrow." And when this guy said that to me, I had this horrible sinking feeling because I got it. I understood what he said. This is not talk. This is action. That means that I have to start showing up in life like I mean this crap. Right? And it means I gotta get in the wheelbarrow. I gotta abandon myself completely and defenselessly in that wheelbarrow and have, let God have his way with me. Well, you know, when you do inventory and you look at your life and you see how much you've hurt yourself and others, and intellectually, I come to appreciate the concept of getting in the wheelbarrow. I like that. I think I like the idea. I see good in it. I like to go to meetings where we read about getting in the wheelbarrow. I like to go out to coffee with people after the meeting and we'll discuss the intricacies of getting in the wheelbarrow. I just ain't getting in the damn wheelbarrow. You know what I'm saying? Right? Because I'm afraid I'll get in that wheelbarrow. I'll get halfway out that wire and I'll hear that voice. Is that Bob? Oh, no. Oh, no. Because I don't trust God. And I don't know how to trust God. How do you trust when you don't know how to trust? What if your fears are louder within you and they clamor more than your faith in God? How do you shift it from faith to trust and actually get in the wheelbarrow? Page 53 talks about what happens to all of us. And we, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous back in the 70s, we used to talk about the second surrender. And that is, the first surrender is you're surrendered and broken by the consequences of the bottle. You're surrendered by the bottle. And then you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and through your very best efforts of wresting happiness and satisfaction out of this world, you're surrendered by life itself as the wheels come off in sobriety. And on page 53, it says, crushed. I like that word, crushed. When Tebow talks about ego reduction, I think crushed is a good word. Crushed by self and by a self-imposed crisis. In other words, you did it. You didn't mean to do it. I know you didn't mean to do it. You did it. You didn't intend to do it. Yeah, I know you didn't intend to do it, but you did it. It's you. Crushed by a self-imposed crisis you could not postpone or evade. Oh, you mean I can't get out of this? You mean the consequences are coming at me? Can I get a lawyer? No, lawyer won't help. Can I get my spot? My spots can't help. Crushed by a self-imposed crisis I cannot postpone or evade, it says I have to fearlessly face the proposition that God is either everything or else he's nothing. He either is or he isn't. Bob, 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 Bob. What's your choice to be? Sometimes your whole life, your whole existence gets down to that choice when you're crushed. I was a couple months sober, 2 months maybe, and I'm overwhelmed with waves of anxiety that are just freaking me out because I had been sentenced to 2 years in a state penitentiary in the state of Pennsylvania by a judge who cut me a break and he stayed the commitment. He put it on hold, conditional on me going into a place and staying there for a year, making the restitution and getting good PO reports and good, you know, your analysis and everything else. And the problem is I can't do it. I couldn't stay sober a year. I got thrown out of there. I'm on the run, hitchhiking cross country. I end up in a detox in Las Vegas. I get out of the detox. I'm in a halfway house. The fog's lifting and the planes are landing. And it's haunting me. And I don't know what to do. And I've had so much therapy. And when you're a thinker and therapy oriented, you don't want to take any action. You just want to talk. Right? as if I can talk myself into some state of relief. So I went to my sponsor to ventilate, talk about my feelings. And people in AA don't really care how you feel. They really care what you do, which is not fair, I don't think. But I'm telling him about about how I feel about all this, and he starts pushing me. Well, you've got to contact your PO and offer to go back there at your own expense and do the 2 years.
And I'm looking at him like, are you out of your mind? I don't jail well. This is not good. I'm going to meetings. I got a sponsor. You're my sponsor. This is good. Look, I'm going to a meeting. I got a commitment. This is good. He says, you have to turn yourself. And he walked me right through it. Scared. I don't want to go. Oh, God, I don't want to do the 2 years. And I followed up everything he said, and I called and my PO on the day I told him in the letter I sent him. And he got on the phone and he told me I didn't have to come back into the 2 years. And in my mind, there was no chance that I was not going to do the 2 years because I knew what the judge said. But he went to bat for me, not because of me, but because of you. Because of the letter you told me to write and the words you told me to say. And it was not a letter I would have written. First of all, he told me to put the address of the halfway house down. I thought that was stupid. And see, you cannot be defended and surrendered at the same time. And I'm not surrendered in here, but you're making me act like a guy who's no longer defended. And I'm getting the same results as someone who really had surrendered, even though I hadn't completely. You're getting me to show up like a surrendered guy. And I took your actions. And it was amazing. It was the first time in my life I ever took actions that were completely against everything I wanted to do. And I came out the other side, and it was the first time I ever realized that maybe I can trust this thing. I didn't know if it was God or AA or my sponsor, but whatever this thing was that seemed to be in my life today, I think maybe I can trust this. And trust is like a muscle. The more you exercise it, the stronger it becomes. And you can only exercise it by your actions. There's no, you can't exercise it sitting in a chair thinking about it. You got to get out there and take the actions. Walk through the fear. And I started to come to trust God, the only way a guy like me could, I suppose, by taking the actions. And it gets easier. It almost becomes a working part of the mind after a while, I guess. I haven't been so afraid in a long time where I can't get in the wheelbarrow. I have little bits of things I worry about from time to time, short-lived usually, because I've got a good track record now with God. You know, God has proved himself over, you know, and it sounds so egomaniacal that God has to prove himself to me, but he did. I didn't deserve it. I'm a doubter. But I got a track record with God. Matter of fact, in my prayers, the last, I don't know how many years, 15, maybe 10, over 10, maybe 15, I started conversational prayers because I found I was using set prayers, St. Francis, seven sets, and they became robotic after a while. After years of saying the same prayers, they eventually, it's like they're nothing. There's no intimacy there with God. When you think about it, I mean, if you wanted to have an intimate relationship with someone, and just once a day for like 20 seconds you ran through a room and recited a paragraph at them and then left, I mean, that's not very intimate. Right, so I started thinking, you know, I should start talking to God as if I wanted to have a relationship with him. And I don't know, many years ago, I was talking to God one morning, doing my deal, and I said to him, I said, look, I really get it that you love me. And I really get it that you're on my side, and I'm gonna try to do whatever I can figure your will is for me. I'm gonna try to do things your way. But if you screw me up, I'm gonna tell everybody. And God, I think God's got his, he thought that was funny. He's got a sense of humor. Only the self-obsessed players of playing God don't have a sense of humor. You don't think God has a sense of humor? Look around the room. He's made some funny shit, I'll tell you. My dear friend Scott Redmond, Scott used to say that when he imagined that when he died, God was going to ask him one question. The question was, did you get the joke? And Scott would say, yeah, it was me, wasn't it? And God would go, yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. So I list my fears. I ask myself, why do I have them? This is where you add onto your eight-step list. Just about everything on resentments, fears, or sex ends up in the eight-step list. And some of you think, well, I would have, I might not have been wrong. Well, it's not about right or wrong. It's about separation. The right or wrong is the domain of the ego. Amends is the domain of the spirit. The spirit yearns for oneness and connectivity and unity. This is about mending the separation. What if they were more wrong than I was? The person with the most spiritual tools does the most work. They don't have the tools. You do. Make the amends. Somebody's got to do it. Do you just want to be right, separate and right? Somebody's got to come off the high horse. They don't have the tools. You do it. I've made a lot of amends to people. If there was any justice in the universe, they should be making amends to me. But they don't have the tools. And I'm sick of the separation. I'm sick of feeling this way. I'm sick of every time I'm around them wanting to have a conversation in my head with them. Right? I'm the guy that's got to make the amends. Or do I want to be free? I want to be free. So we ask ourselves why we have the fears. And often, unfinished business pops up. I had a guy a few years ago. A guy sponsored. And I'm unfair with these guys because I know I sponsor a lot of guys. So I know stuff about them that they don't know I know about them. This guy, I said to him, I said, I want you to meet me this certain night over at this meeting. And he said, I'm not going. I don't want to go over there. I said, how come? I already know. He said, I said, how come? Why don't you want to go to that meeting? It's just not my kind of meeting. I don't really like the people there that much. It's not my kind of people. I said, so you got a resentment over there? No resentment. No, I just not my kind of people. I said, so the idea of going over there seems to make you a little anxious. What's got you anxious about? Is there any individual over there that you're anxious about being around? No, I'm just not my kind of people, that's all. I said, well, who in particular? Well, you know, so-and-so, I don't really care for him, not my kind of guy. Just don't like him, that's all. You don't have to like everybody, do you? No, I guess not. Book says we have to have a kindly and tolerant attitude towards him. But I said, why don't you like him? Why do you feel uncomfortable around him? Why do you get a little anxiety at the proposition spending an hour and a half in a room with him? And he just looks at me, and I said, is it because you talk crap about him behind his back to anyone who will listen, and you're afraid it's gotten back to him, and now you don't want to be around him? Because you're scared that he's heard the things you've been saying behind his back. And he looks at me like deer in the headlights, like, how do you know that? Well, I know me, and I know you, and I've heard you talk crap about me. So, and I can't imagine I'm the only one in AA you've talked crap about this guy to. So we become hostage to our own self-seeking behavior and our own selfishness. Some people have anxiety about doing their taxes. Why? Because you've been cheating on your taxes. It's not a mystery. Why do you have the fear? What's the unfinished business that you need to walk through and take care of here? Why do you have the fear? And do you trust God enough to walk through the fear and make this right? scary stuff. All this stuff is a process and it all interlocks. It's really hard to talk about step four without talking about the end game, which is step nine. Because that you don't, and it's how often you get these fears. You got this sex situations or people you're uncomfortable around because you were very selfish with you know self gratifying with them at their expense, or maybe you have judgments and resentments, and you can get a better attitude towards them in the fourth and fifth step, but you don't get free until you make the amends. When you think about it, it makes perfect sense. If you've done something to hurt someone, then until you make that right, you're vested in finding a way to have a judgment against them to justify not making it right in what you did to them. It's like if you've ever worked somewhere and you've stolen from where you work, you will have to find a way to make your boss out to be a jerk in order to justify not facing it and paying him back. So we become hostages to our own selfish behavior. We're prisoners. It's a piece and parcel of the bondage of self. And we ask God to relieve us of the bondage of self. And now we're engaging in the process that opens us up and allows his grace in to actually do that, what we ask him to do. But it doesn't. The fourth and fifth step is not the end game. It's really just the beginning in the process of freedom that meets fruition in the ninth step as I go out and do the hardest thing I'll ever do. And this in step nine is really where you get to develop trust in God, because it's frightening stuff. It's because I don't know what's more frightening. I think I'm more defended with my pride, I think, at times than I am my physical. The idea of you taking a baseball bat to me is not as bad as the idea of me being publicly humiliated in front of you. I mean, that's really frightening to me, for me to look bad. I'd rather take a beating. Matter of fact, I remember growing up, there was a guy bigger than I was, 2 years older than I was, tougher than I was, and I would not stop fighting him. And I knew there's no chance that I'm going to win and he's going to beat me to a pulp. But I would rather take the beating than to let him and these other guys know how scared I am. I would rather take the beating. That I am so obsessed with what people think of me, I would rather put myself in physical danger than to look weak to other people. And the problem is I am weak. Because a strong person doesn't have to prove that they're strong. Only weak, scared people have to try to prove that they're strong and they're not weak. Really strong people, they're good. They're good. They don't have to prove nothing. Guys like me that have a big hole inside of them, we always have to prove what we are. We're always looking and concerned with what you think of me. As if the illusion is if I can get you thinking I'm cool, maybe I'll be cool. It's a shame it doesn't work that way. Because when you finally think I'm cool, I just know you're stupid. That's all. So I bet you there's people in this room that have had people of the opposite sex or their sexual preference fall madly in love with them. And the minute that person falls madly in love with them and they're just crazy about you, you automatically lose respect for them, don't you? I mean, you may not be perfect, but you want to partner with taste, for God's sakes. Well... Because we're both up here together doesn't mean we're going to do sex here. We're going to do questions here.
But if you have a camera.
Pull it out.
I like this. I like the questions because they stretch me. And so, how about if you want
to take that one for you?
No, I don't. There's not. There's not. Why don't you take one, answer it, and then if I want to say five words on it, I can. And then you, okay. And I'll take a question, and then you could say if you want to comment on that. We'll just go back and forth.
Okay. The question is it okay to start work on one step before you finished an earlier step? I would say probably not. However, I will say this, that I was practicing the 11th step while I was going through the rest of the book. My sponsor showed me where that was and went through those directions, and I was practicing those directions out of the book while I was going through the rest of the book, the rest of the steps. But I found like each step builds on itself, and the power to do the other steps, like inventory, amends, fist up, all that stuff, was built on the previous step. So that's my experience with that.
Me too. You don't have God's phone number to ask him, so call your sponsor. How often should a thorough house cleaning been done in recovery? There's a debate in AA that I think is silly about we only work the first 9 steps once, they do 10, 11. I know the truth. We all leak. If you did a perfect step 10 and 11 every day, you'd be good to go. But I know whatever, it doesn't matter what you call it. If you're like me, you leak, you get full of yourself, and you're going to have to intermittently do a major house cleaning. And I'll tell you how you can tell. Look around you. When you start noticing a lot of selfish, self-centered people, you better do an inventory.
Agree. Nothing new to add to that. Oh, wow. How do you determine whether it is self-esteem, personal relation, sex relation, or security that is interfered with for resentment? I just asked myself a question. How do you determine whether it is self-esteem, personal relations, sex relations, or securities that is interfered with for resentment? So third column in our resentment inventory, how do you tell which one is hurt, threatened, or interfered with? What was given to me that helps me is I was just given a question with each one, security. What do I think I need here? And is that being hurt, threatened, or interfered with? That's how I determine it. Or ambition, pocketbook, personal relations, what I want, my ambitions, my self-esteem, how I want you to see me or others. So asking myself those questions.
Good. What was your most difficult amends, and how did you get past the fear of facing it? There's the quick burn and the slow burn. The quick burn is like facing my PO and the risk of going to prison. It was a whole lot of anxiety in a very short period of time. It was intense. But then there's slower amends that are very difficult because you have to persist. Like my mother and father, just me saying I was sorry was meaningless. I'd been so sorry with them over the years. They didn't trust anything I said. And it took a long time of cards and letters and phone calls. When I paid for the phone call, I remember the first time people in AA told me, you need to start calling your mom. And I said, well, they won't take my calls. And this person in AA said, well, don't call collect. That is such a novel idea to me. I mean, it was like, that shows you how self-centered I am and selfish. I didn't even think about paying for the call. I mean, the first time I ever called, my mom gets on the phone. She hears my voice. She panics. What do you want? Oh, my God, you're back in Pennsylvania again. No, I said, Mom, I'm in Nevada. She said, you're in Nevada? Well, the operator didn't ask me to pay for the call. I said, no, Mom, I paid for the call. She went, you paid for the call? She couldn't believe it. It was like, because it wasn't me, it was you. And you walked me. It took a long time. I tell you, Chamberlain used to talk about you, your actions will rub away the debt in time. It takes a long, the book says there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. If you have loved ones that you have broken their heart over and over and over and over again, it may take a long period of time of acting different than they have ever seen you act before. You're going to rub away all that mistrust and all that hurt. But there is a spiritual principle that you cannot continue to mistrust and resent someone who is consistently lovingly on your side. The love and the actions will wear your resentment and your distrust away in time. But it may take years. And we have short attention spans. I want to say I'm sorry. I want to balloon in parades. You know what I'm saying? Right? And it doesn't, sometimes it doesn't work that way. And that's the real long haul. Are you in this? Are you in this as a way of life, or are you in it just for quick relief? Because sometimes it's not quick relief. Sometimes it's a major change in how you show up.
My experience is the same with family, making amends. There was probably 5 years of showing up consistently with my mother and being available to her, that when I made a sudden movement, she didn't flinch. Because if I moved quick, she would flinch because she didn't know it was coming, because I had a small anger problem. And it was frightening to her and to other people, because I would come after you physically if you made me mad. So it took a long time. And in AA, I mean, I wish I could tell you I didn't carry that behavior into AA, but I did. And it took a long time for people in Alcoholics Anonymous to not give me a wide berth when I got upset. It was genuinely frightening to them. They didn't know what I was going to do next. I mean, totally unpredictable. So it has taken consistent action and being changed also. I mean, God changed me. I mean, I couldn't do that stuff today if I wanted to, and God knows I want to sometimes. I'll just say that. But I can't do it even if I wanted to. But it's from taking the actions that I was changed, and the surrender to what's that saying? God abhors a vacuum. So, you know, with that surrender, God will fill that void. The other amends that were very difficult for me to make, besides my family, were financial amends. I had really some funky ideas about money, and I had entitlement issues, and I was a thief for a very long time. And I had to pay all of that back. I was not I was not allowed not to. And I've seen some stuff in AA where they're like, they didn't know about it, don't worry about it. Or they told you not to pay it back, so don't worry about it. And that's just not how I was raised, but that's my experience. But that's not how I was raised. I was told very clearly, you took it out of the world, you're putting it back into the world. And even when I went to go make amends to someone, they said, don't worry about it, I'm glad you're doing well, you know, whatever. I had to go put that money somewhere else, give it away somewhere else. I was not allowed to keep it. And that was incredibly objectionable to me, starting off, and very uncomfortable because I had so much fear around money. But the interesting thing is the more, I just had to be willing and do it. And the more money, and it took me years and years, this was not an overnight matter at all, years and years and years to pay off these financial amends. But as I continued to show up and willing to pay these things monthly, every month, more money started coming into my life to help me pay that off. And that was my first responsibility after my other bills were paid. So the important thing, I guess, for me in that with amends is that if I'm willing to make the amends, no matter how frightening it is and how resistant I am to it, God always will provide the ways and means for me to do it. I've never had that withheld from me. I think God's like thrilled when we're like, you know, I want to give back what I've taken and will help me do that. I'm not out there standing alone, even though it felt like that and I didn't understand how that would happen. I mean, it was terrifying to me to start paying that money back because I had none. I could barely feed myself, so, and I've got to start making financial restitution. But I did it anyway and trusted the big book that what it was telling me was true, and I trusted sponsorship. And I did not want to go back to the way I was living. I wanted to be changed. And they told me if I would do these things, I would be. So that's my experience with that. I felt like Forrest Gump there for a second. And that's all I have to say about that. Here, this one's yours. That's a hot topic.
Step up to the mic.
Oh, sorry. How do I re-energize my program, spirituality, relationship with God when I've lost some trust in God? Help somebody else. Take them through the steps.
I heard my sponsor say, he's 56 and a half years sober. He said if he wouldn't have started working with newcomers, he would have probably left AA when he was 5 years sober because he'd already gotten everything he was going to get as a taker. Yeah. And it was his enthusiasm and his spirit stayed alive all these years from being a giver. So do you have an example of the first tradition playing out? Yeah. A couple. The first tradition, you know, Wilson says something in his story. He says a price has to be paid. It means the destruction of self-centeredness. And I think the personal application of the traditions in my life is really how a guy like me takes the practicing of these principles in all my affairs to a new level. Because there's a selflessness in the positioning of those principles in my life. Because the first tradition is I'm last. It's God's first, you're second, I'm last. That the common welfare, that everybody else here and how they're doing is more important than I am. That's for selfish people. That is not palatable. And yet, that is the essence of altruism, and Alcoholics Anonymous is an altruistic program. And I'll tell you another thing. I was in a rehab with a guy, and he was my run-in partner. We weren't really sober, but we weren't drinking. We were smoking marijuana because when they made us go to the meetings, you were more interesting if we were stoned on pot, basically. And I went back to drinking, of course, and he saw me on the streets, and I was a mess. And it shocked him, and he went and changed his sobriety date. He got a sponsor, not just a sponsor. He got one of those fanatical guys we used to make fun of with the book and the whole, you know, he got one of those guys as a sponsor. And he started working the steps. And he started doing service in AA. Now, I don't know any of this. I'm on the streets. And months later, I end up, close to a year later, I end up in another treatment center. And he's one of the guys bringing the meetings in there. And he was one of the guys that was right in the middle of AA. He was a part of you. And he was doing very well. And it was my first example of how personal recovery depends upon AA unity. He had to become a part of you for him to get better. As it talks about in the the medical view of alcoholism, one of the psychiatrists talks about how Alcoholics Anonymous brings to bear the two most powerful forces in humanity, the force of religious insight and the herd instinct. And the herd instinct, you have to, whatever you have to let go of, whatever judgment, whatever resentment, whatever attitude, whatever selfishness that you have that keeps you a part of the herd here, whether it's the selfishness that gives you an entitlement to text during the meeting or the selfishness that gives you the entitlement to come late even though you think everybody else should be on time, but my case is special. Whatever keeps you separate and apart from it, above the herd or below the herd, has got to go so you can be in the herd. And we hate that, don't we? Because we're not joiners. We're leaders. We all fancy ourselves leading a charge. There's nobody behind us, but we're leading a charge into some new way of life. And nobody behind us, but we're, and we got to give that up and become one with. My personal recovery depends upon AA unity. I got to be a part of here. You've got to all be a part to stay together so I can be a part of you. But I've got to be a part of here. I can't put myself up above you or below you. And if I've done anything that makes me feel below you, I got to go make it right. That's why, I'll tell you a little story. I sponsor a guy who's one of the top dog trainers in the country. He trains all the drug dogs, the SWAT team dogs. He's really very good. And he's got some remarkable dogs. I mean, these dogs, I've never seen a dog trained like this. He's got one dog. He's got a dog. He says, sit. And he never tells it not to sit. It will starve to death. It will not move. And I asked him one time, I said, man, you're the best dog trainer I've ever met. I said, do you think you could train a dog to crap in its own food bowl? And he said, no, I don't think I could do that. And I said, isn't that something? Because an alcoholic will shit where he eats every goddamn time. Isn't that the truth? We will do it. We'll be predators in the one, financial or sexual, in the one place that's saving our lives. We'll crap where we're supposed to eat. Because we're selfish and self-centered. And we have to lose all that here to stay here. You can't, takers don't stay in AA.
How do we make amends to an institution that we no longer are part of?
Or pants off.
Yeah. No longer are part of. I guess you're talking somewhere you used to work or belong without knowing more about the situation. I don't know if they're closed down or I'd have to know more about it. If they're closed down, then, and it depends what is the amends. I mean, there's more questions on this one that need to be answered, in my opinion.
Sometimes you have to do a little work. If the business that you're involved in was sold, maybe you go back and find the family and you pay them. There's always a way. God provides a way. You know, it's just having an open mind is the hard part. Because it's easy to go, oh, got ducked that one. How do you get beyond the fear that everyone is judging you, including God? Well, they actually are judging you. No, they're not judging you any more than you're judging them. There's a line in our book that says that we do talk about each other quite a lot, but it is tempered with the spirit of love and tolerance. That's offensive to some people because they want to keep everything in the shade. But AA is somewhat of a glass house here. And if you want to have a secret life and you want to do things that you're ashamed of, that makes it hard to be a member of AA. But it's a glass house. I mean, the people die because they have secret lives here. And a friend of mine says, you can do anything you want as long as you can talk about it openly in front of your home group. Now, that eliminates a lot of stuff. But there is an accountability in the herd here. Yeah. And here's the deal. We're all on the same page. When I do something that I'm afraid you would judge me for, it's because if you did it, I would judge you for it. We're all on the same page here. And so that if you allow God to work through the group conscience and your conscience, there's accountability there. We all know what we're supposed to do. We just don't like it. We like the self-gratification stuff. But we all know, we all have internal, unless you're a sociopath, you have within you the knowledge of right and wrong. You have the knowledge of what you should do. We just don't always agree with it. So let your home group know what's going on. Be transparent. That's my first sponsor used to say that all the time. You got to be transparent. Well, what if they don't like me? Well, you won't be the only guy. You got to be transparent.
Yeah, it just makes me think of a couple things that my sponsor used to say to me. He would say, Valerie, there are people that will love you no matter what you do. There are people that will never love you no matter what you do. So, you know, lead a life that makes sense to you, and hopefully you're doing that within and with your Creator. And hope, you know, live in a transparent life. What kills me is we are a judgmental lot. We are some of the most judgmental people I know. Like, we have any business judging anybody.
Right.
But we'll just, you know, we'll march right on up there with our, I would never do that.
At least not all day.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. You know, just we can be so judgmental. And that's where, you know, compassion is important. Being properly armed with facts about yourself. For me, I've become more compassionate and less judgmental the longer I've been sober, because I can see my own darkness and I know that I'm capable of just about anything given the right circumstance, right? So what's most important to me is my relationship with my Creator, and am I living a life that makes sense to me? I mean, I don't want to harm anybody. I don't want to take from anybody. I want to be a giver. I want to be in that brotherhood stream. You know, those are my values and principles today. Am I living up to that the best of my ability? You know, am I being transparent with people about what I'm really doing, what I'm really thinking, how I'm really living? And most of the time, yeah, at that moment, sometimes it takes me a couple days. But yes, that's how I live. Because the price is too high not to. So
I think the problem is not that I'm judgmental, it's that I'm selfishly judgmental and not complete in the judgment. I want to judge just enough to puff my ego up and feel superior. But if I really judged like God judges, then I would see past the things that I can feel better than you about to see the truth about you, which you're just like me. If I could see you the way God sees you, I don't have a problem with you. I might have a little compassion. I might think, oh my God, I did that stuff. It's a shame you're hurting yourself like that. How can I help? It's the ego likes to judge and feel smugly superior. But that's an erroneous, a delusional judgment, because that's not the truth. The truth is that if I could really judge you and see the whole picture, I would see everything God sees. I would see the pain. I would see the fears, the things that are driving you because they're in me. And I wouldn't have any conflict with you. I'd actually feel closer to you because you're me. You're me. See, that's the problem. The ego just wants to judge enough to feel superior. It doesn't want to go all the whole nine yards, right? If it went the whole nine yards, we'd feel closer. Doesn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is it your turn?
No, it's your turn.
Is it? I think it's your turn.
No, no, it's your turn.
Okay. You want the long one?
I'll trade you.
That's awesome. Keep that for later.
I don't know what that's about.
I did.
I don't. Oh, this is for you.
Is it?
Divinely ordered.
I want to be rid of my hot temper and quick, smart mouth. Now, why do you want to get rid of that? I believe God can remove these, but I don't even quite know how to inventory them. I want to be rid of my hot temper and quick, smart mouth. I believe God can remove these, but I don't even quite know how to inventory them. Well, let me tell you a little story. So now I want y'all to all know that this was when I was right on the verge of becoming the queen of AA. It was getting ready to happen. I was almost there. So I'm in this group that I started all by myself. That I named all by myself. And great AA was going on at that meeting. And a woman showed up at our closed discussion big book topic meeting, which I had, you know, tremendous superiority feelings about over all other meetings in the Richmond area. Because they were all doing it wrong. And if you wanted real AA recovery, you come to Jaywalkers. That's where the magic happens. So, anyway, this woman comes into our meeting, our closed discussion meeting. She introduces herself as an addict. And I noticed this during the meeting, but I maintained composure. I didn't let anybody know that that was upsetting to me. But after the meeting, as a responsible home group member, I felt it was my job and my opportunity to go up and educate her on her erroneous description of who she is in a closed AA meeting. That in a closed AA meeting, we are just alcoholics. And I'm going to fix her and get her in line with traditions, and she needs to be clear on what her truth is if she wants to live. And I'm going to impart this information to her. So, being the authoritative, good AA member that I am, I go up to her and say, you know, this is a closed discussion AA meeting, and it is the conscience of this home group that while you are in this meeting that you identify yourself as an alcoholic, and that's it. Not an addict or an alcoholic and anything. I mean, completely arrogant and not and ignorant. And she said, oh yeah? Well, you can't tell me what to do, and I can come to this meeting if I want to, and I can introduce myself however I want to. I mean, them were fighting words, man. I mean, it was like instantaneous. You know, when Bob was talking about my, when I get afraid, feel hurt, threatened, I felt threatened. And my knee-jerk response was anger. And I'm going to take you down. Are you talking to me? I am soon to be elected the queen of AA. Do you know what I know? And how I'm going to save Alcoholics Anonymous in Richmond, Virginia? And you're threatening that? And I mean, I went off. A fine example of Alcoholics Anonymous this night. I was telling her how I was going to rip off her top part and shove it up her bottom part. There's other AA members walking around. There's little children walking around because we have babysitting at our meeting. I mean, this, I had a moment, you know? And I've been through the steps. I've taken inventory. I'm still in the process of making amends. I'm saving Richmond AA. I'm helping people. And I just lost it. I called them. And when I'm done exploding, I mean, it was really ugly. My conduct was really, really ugly. And I go into the bathroom and I pray, and I know immediately that I am wrong. And I go out and I make amends immediately. Called my sponsor the next day. The only question he asked me is, why were you so threatened? It's a good question. I was afraid she was right, and I was wrong. But, I mean, there was just no compassion anywhere. I forgot what the question was.
Dealing with your anger and your
smile. Oh, that experience brought me to a complete bottom where I surrendered. That's what happened. I did not have another explosion like that after that happened. I mean, I've gotten angry and raised my voice and have gone to war here and there, but nothing like that ever again. There was a huge surrender that night with me, where that absolutely became objectionable to me, and where I was willing to go to any length to not ever do that again. That woman ended up committing suicide. She couldn't stay. If anything that I did that night had anything to do from keeping her from the message of hope that we have here, even though I cleaned it up immediately. You know, I don't know if she held on to that and my conduct there. You know what I mean? So when I'm done with it, when it's not giving me juice anymore, is when I surrender it. That's been my experience with that.
Nice. I had two instances in my early sobriety where I got violent with people. And they were embarrassing. And they were humiliating. The one, I was a DCM and conference chairman of a convention, and I physically did bodily harm to a guy. I'm not proud of that. And the sad part is that's 33 years ago, I guess, and I've never found those guys to make amends. And I think about them all the time. And I always feel embarrassed when I think about it. And I think coming out... Sometimes step six, becoming entirely ready, just looks like you can't stand yourself anymore. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. You can't be the way you are another minute. You can't stand it. And sometimes we hit these bottoms with that stuff. And I haven't acted in anger towards someone and violently or yelled or anything in over 30 years. And it never was anger anyway. I was just so scared. I was so full of fear. How do you know what God's will is? Well, you want to, if you go to enough meetings, you'll listen, and people who find God's will become successful and have a lot of money and stuff. So you're going to try to figure it out so you get a bigger piece of the pie. I don't know what God's will is sometimes, but I usually know what it's not. Don, my friend Don, used to say, well, before you make a decision to do something, ask God, will you go with me to do this? And if it's something that's right, you'll feel it inside and go, yeah, I'm on board, I'm with you. If it ain't right, God ain't going. I have a sponsor because of a hideous dynamic that seems to exist in me. And what that is that the times I need direction and a sense of God's will the most is usually the times I'm the most clouded. And I'm the most fearful and the most disconnected. So one of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous is we're not all spiritually disconnected on the same day. And I'll call my sponsor, and I've had this, the reverse of this, when my sponsor may be disconnected until I call him and ask for help, and then you hear the loud pop as his head comes out of his butt to try to help me. And the reverse. I've had guys call me that I sponsor, and I'm like self-obsessed, and I'm just like, whoa. And they'll have a problem, and all of a sudden I just show up again. It's like you relieve me of the bondage of self. So I will always have to seek a vision of God's will through other people. I tell the guys I sponsor, if you get inspired and you think you know what God's will is, you better call me. It's a real big inspiration, I think you got to come and see me. Got two more?
That's a really smart person question.
There'll be somebody like that here eventually.
Step three says make a decision. How does that affect how you do step three? I don't know. I just make a decision. I get on my knees and say the prayer. I think my decision is made once I say the prayer. And that's how I do it.
The word decision comes from Latin scissore. It's the root word for the word to cut. Like in scissors or incision, when a surgeon cuts into a patient. If you, in your innermost self, truly have done step one and two, or the ABCs, you've effectively cut away all the alternatives. The decision is made itself. There's nothing left. There's nowhere else to go. You're screwed. There's either a power greater than yourself that you can turn yourself into that's going to do something for you you can't do for yourself, or you're screwed. So it's really a not nothing left to lose step. If you've done step one and step two. And those are the only two problems that anyone, a guy like me would ever have with step three, would be step one and step two. Step three is almost automatic. What is willing to go to any length? What is any length? It's just a little bit further than you've ever gone. Just a little bit.
So the last part is, we talked about cleaning house, trusting God, and then helping others. So that's the point of why we work the steps, ultimately. At the beginning of the book, in Doctor's Opinion, it's telling me what this way of life is going to be about. It tells me right up front, it's not going to be about you. Your sobriety is not going to be for you. It's going to be for other people. That it's an altruistic way of life, that it's a life of service. The good news is that we're given the power to do that. My experience was, as I began to wake up spiritually, I could not go help other people. It wasn't even a choice. Thank you. It wasn't even a choice. I had to do it. I could not do it. And even today, there's something wrong if I'm not talking to somebody about my relationship with my Creator and how I got it on a daily basis. One-on-one with another alcoholic in a meeting or getting to be here with you guys today. I mean, and that's all we do is we go and talk to hopeless people, dying people. We're, sitting in the dark. We walk right on in there. And we say, we got an answer for that. I'm like you. And I got out. The this is what I did. Do you want to come with me? And that is my primary purpose. Everything has been added to my life. I've been taken care of in every way, emotionally, mentally, spiritually, financially, job-wise, when that's been my primary purpose, is to stay sober and help another alcoholic. Does it make sense on paper? Or does it make sense in my head? But that's the reality of what's happened. And it's the best life I didn't know I wanted. So, you know, they talk about a fellowship grows up about you when you're willing to live this way. You'll never be lonely again. As a matter of fact, it would be like, Jesus Christ, will my phone please stop? I don't want to talk to one more crazy person today. I'm just kidding. Well, sometimes that happens. But on the whole, I mean, the reality is I should be dead or locked up. Shouldn't even have a phone. People weren't ringing my phone. I wasn't invited or welcomed out. So it's amazing what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of surrendering your life to this power. And I get to stay sober as long as I'm willing to do that. That's how I keep in fit spiritual condition. I've been put back together in my willingness to work with other people. I am at my absolute best when I'm one-on-one with another alcoholic. That is when I'm at my best, one-on-one. And that's all I have to say about that. Thanks for having me.
What a great experience. Thanks so much, Valerie and Bob. We really appreciate it. We all helped me. Thank you. Are there any AA-related announcements? Okay. Newcomers, is there anyone here that's in their first 30 days, just so we can get to know you? If you want to raise your hand and just introduce yourself by your first name.
I'm Randall, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Randall, welcome. Anyone else?
Garrett,
hey, Garrett, welcome. Desiree, welcome. Anybody else? Yeah. What was your name? Julian. Julian, welcome. Glad you're here. All right, and to lead up into this, one more.
What? I'm Sam, and I'm alcoholic.
Hey, Sam, welcome. Really glad you all are here. So sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, if you'll please raise your hand. A lot of people in the room. So if you have any questions about sponsorship or would like additional information, grab one of those people that just had their hand raised at the end of this, and welcome aboard. smokers, please use the cans provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website. You can also sign up on our website where we'll shoot you a little email to remind you of any events. We do these twice a year, and we also have our sub-room speaker about the 13th or 14th week after we go through the book. We have a sub-room speaker, so for those events as well, and we can keep in contact with you to let you know when we have those, so you can register for that on the website. When we finish up here today, we need to break down the tables, throw away the tablecloths, and put the chairs back the way they were last night, so they'll be in two sections here of just chairs. And thanks again. for the two of you. Okay. I'm going to read the last two pages on 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. And Jill just reminded me, at the table, if you have any plates or silverware things, food that you brought, please take them out as you leave. We've got about half an hour before we need to be out of the church. And if you'll help me close with the Lord's Prayer.
Trespass against us, and lead us not into temptation.